Free stuff tastes better. Fact.
It's not a fact.
It tastes like I won something. It's like my taste buds know I've not been charged and they're celebrating.
You think your taste buds have counted your change?
Try it.
It tastes like coffee.
It tastes like free coffee. And all I had to do was collect four little beans.
Costa Club members who buy four handcrafted drinks at Costa Coffee get the fifth free when they use a reusable cup. Because at Costa Coffee, loyalty is a big deal. Subject to availability only at selected stores. Excludes delivery. Terms and conditions at costa.co.uk.
FBref.com is your World Cup headquarters, packed with all the information you need to keep up with the action in Qatar. FBref is the number one free football website with formations and tactical data, match previews, and advanced stats like XG to help you understand every moment of the tournament. Plus, once it's over, our extensive coverage has over 140 competitions, including in-depth information on both the Premier League and the Championship. To see it all, head to fbref.com/World Cup.
You're listening to Dropping the Gloves with former NHL All-Star John Scott, a member of the Nation Network of Podcasts and delivered by DoorDash.
How's it going, everybody? Thank you for joining us here on another episode of Dropping the Gloves. You know, it's not often, Tim, I get a guest coming on who I think I have a cool story. You know, undrafted free agent, rags to riches story, makes the NHL, all-star game. Did you know I made the all-star game, Tim? Did you know that?
You brought it up once or twice.
All-star game appearance, MVP, no big deal. And then this guy comes along. And he just one-ups me, and it's fantastic. I love it, because there's not enough stories like this. But Aaron Volpatti's joining the show. Aaron, thanks for joining us, my man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's good to be here. Good to meet you officially.
Officially?
And officially. Don't you have a movie? So I don't know if is that. I don't know if that's one-up, really.
Well, it's there's been some recent events with this movie. It's a pain in my... No, not yet. I do have a book, though. Not as good as yours. My book, it's funny. People, they'll ask, you got a book? And I'll go, no, don't buy it because it's garbage. I don't like it.
So, did you write it?
I wrote it. Well, I had a ghostwriter help me along the way. And he would send me just chapters. And I would read the chapters and I would say, these suck. I don't like them. This doesn't sound like me. And so then I would go ahead and write it. And it would just went back and forth. But you know, when you write a book and I was a certain person, you know, I was coming off the show. Everything was great, all-star game, and I think I had an inflated ego, and I was just feeling myself, and I write a book. And then 2 years go by, and I go, I'm a completely different person.
Right.
And I'm like, what? So people read that book, and they go, ooh, John, like, loves to do this and that and this and that and the other. And that's not how I am at all. Now I'm just like, Catholic, seven kids, engineer.
Yeah. So, yeah. That was a big challenge for me too with my book, was just, I didn't want to ever be, hey, look what I did. Look at me. And that was, or, you know, just opening up and being vulnerable in general, because we're not taught that as men, but in the hockey world. Right. And so there was twofold there of the challenges, I guess, with it. There's a cat in the background.
There's a cat cruises by. Well, let's talk about your book though, because it's interesting. You played 100 games in the show. Who cares about 114 whatever. Or whatever?
Yeah.
Who cares about Aaron Volpatti? Why do I pick up your book if you're just a fourth line schmelt like me? Are you just trying to collect a quick buck? Like, what's so interesting about Aaron Volpatti?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, I did this to, I'm like, I can help people with this and empower people with, you know, the power of the mind, really. And I think this is probably where our stories maybe overlap a little bit. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I was never supposed to play in the NHL. Like, I really wasn't that good. You know, above average minor hockey player, sure. But I played house hockey at like 14.
And me too.
Got cut from select teams, all that stuff. Scored one goal my first year in junior A, and I was just a pure fighter. And I'm not a big guy, but, you know, that's what I did. And so I was never supposed to play in the NHL And then this burn injury happened. And so, yeah, really, like, if you want to talk about odds stacked against you, I mean, again, I don't like to maybe toot my own horn. Look what I did. But more the message is, if I can play in the NHL, believe me, you can do anything you want.
It was funny. My parents are visiting from Canada. I'm in Michigan now. And we're at dinner. And my mom goes, you know, I think your older brother could have made the NHL. He was a really good hockey player. And I had to stop her in her tracks. And I said, Jamie was good. He was like, I think people just think it's somewhat easy to make the NHL, where they just see people on the TV and like, okay, if I really work hard, I can make it. No, you can't. There takes a certain level of talent and overcoming adversity. And you have to have, so I know you're selling yourself short where it's like, okay, I had one goal and this and that. Your college coach, I read, he said you were the hardest hitter he's ever seen, ever.
My thing. I could always hit.
But that's hard to do. That's very difficult to do. So you had some talent. A lot of people have talent, but you have to work with that. It takes a lot of mental strength to be able to say, okay, I'm not going to score goals. This is how I'm going to make it to the NHL. Did you ever see guys? We talked about this with Michael Pezzetta. Did you ever see guys who were just incredibly talented and they just didn't have the work ethic?
Oh, all the time. And I think that's what, you know, how many guys did you play with that had loads more talent than you and they never made it? Right. Because I think that filter, as you move up, starts getting like this, starts getting smaller and smaller. And then it's like, okay, what else do you do? Right.
Yeah.
You got to do something else. And sometimes it was just, are you willing to do what other people don't want to do? Like, I didn't really want to fight guys that were 6'5 and 240 pounds. I'm like 6'1, 205. So I don't really want to do that, but I know I'm not going to make it, you know, the other way. So, it's a tough one, but you have to have something else. Because the guys with talent, I think that's the big thing. When things start getting hard, then what? And then they fall off because it's hard. And like you said, that journey might take, I was 25 when I turned pro. So that journey might take a while.
Yeah.
And I think now, I don't know what you see where you guys are, but it's a full-time job for these kids at like 10 years old. And no wonder they're burnt out at 18, you know, and it's a full-time job from like such a young age. I don't know. That's a whole other topic, but
yeah,
you can have all the talent in the world, but when you're just like, man, I'm out, you know, I see that all the time.
But. Well, because it is a job. I think you nailed it where it's not fun anymore. And we're throwing stones, but you just look at the way people they approach hockey nowadays. Everybody, they have a trainer, they have a nutritionist, they have all this stuff 24/7, mental coaches. I didn't have any of that junk.
No, exactly. And there's like non-sanctioned leagues here for 8-year-olds. And it's like, whoa, what are we doing here? You know, and
it's a lot.
I say this to like people I work with and everything where, you know, when you're like 14 to 18, then it's time to like start getting obsessed. And if you want to do something, you have a window here, but you're like talking about 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds. Like, I don't know, just go have fun. You're a kid.
And yeah, I think it's impossible.
That's what's getting, it is. Cause then my son or daughter will fall behind.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, you and I played house hockey at 14. They'll be fine.
But going back to your story, I'm looking at your stats, where you came from, how you developed. You went to Brown. You got the sweater on, obviously bragging.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that till now. Yeah.
And Brown's a good school. It's a great Division I school. How do you did not put up points in the BCHL. No. And I'm not throwing shade because I didn't do it with MTU. I was a stay-at-home defenseman. You're a forward.
Yeah.
How do you go from the Vernon Vipers, where you're getting 18 points in 57 games, to going to Brown and getting a scholarship? How does that work?
Yeah, well, this is where the story, I guess, gets good, or it's like the meat of the story is when I really learned about the power of the mind and the visualization piece. So I guess that's a good segue. I'll just go right into it. So my second year in Vernon, we lost out in the finals. And back then, you know, this is 20 years ago. I don't know what the kids do now, but we would go party for a week. That's just what we did, right?
They go train now.
Yeah.
And cry.
Yeah. So it was like day two or three of this bender. And I was always that guy that maybe a lot of us as a young teenager that, you know, you think you're invincible, doing stupid things. And I was always a pyro. So I was always messing around with gas and fire. And again, no kidding. Part of it was, I think we chatted about this before jumping on here, but I was and I can reflect now and understand this, but I was just feeding a young ego, you know, mm-hmm. whether it be, I was living up to that fighter stereotype, I guess you could say, where, hey, you're the crazy guy. And part of it was, hey, I like the adrenaline and I like the attention from maybe girls that comes of it or whatever, right? It's mm-hmm. just, you're just feeding an ego.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And I thought I was invincible. And one thing led to another. And we were camping out in the bush, like I said, day two or three of this bender. And I was basically doing a spin-off Molotov cocktails. So I was like basically blowing up beer bottles full of gas. And so not smart, obviously. And I actually had two wine bottles full of gas. And I was walking around the party and I was like kind of getting everyone revved up. I had done this the year before and everything went up without a hitch and everything was fine. And I mean, it's all fine until someone gets hurt. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I felt soaking wet. So I'm walking around and we'd obviously been drinking and and I'm like, I have a liter and a half of gas on me now. And I know there's a fire and I know I have gas and I know, hey, I probably shouldn't get too close to this thing, but I didn't respect the dangers of, you know, gasoline or the gasoline vapors. Yeah, right? They just kind of settle around you. And I think maybe 5 minutes or so went by and I'm like, I got to get this sweater off. Like I just reek like gas and maybe I didn't want to litter. Or maybe I'm like, well, I'll just light the sweater on fire. But that gas is still all over me. Right. And so I keep what I think is a safe distance away and I, you know, give the ground a little kick and it was just like, and up I went. And unfortunately I bolted and that fight or flight takes over and I was pretty quick. So I just shot out of
and
a
the
cannon.
Fire just engulfs you.
I'm on
you.
Fire. You yeah. can't put out a gas fire, which I didn't know at the time.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get it out. And obviously did a lot of damage. And finally, people always ask me, like, were you in a lot of pain? And, you know, that shock takes, it's kind of like being in a fight. You don't feel it in the moment, yeah. right? And I just remember feeling really warm and in no pain. There's this eerie sense of calmness to the whole thing. And I feel like that's probably what dying feels like, you know, just mm-hmm. peace. I was warm. And then all of a sudden, finally, I got hit from behind and the guys tackled me and started beating me with their jackets. Like everyone burnt their hands trying to put this thing out.
No kidding.
And so that's how the journey really started for me. So unfortunately, we were out in the bush, 30 minutes from town, no cell service. Thankfully, one of the guy's girlfriends wasn't drinking. I piled in her car. And we sped off to the hospital. And you want to talk about pain when that shock started wearing off. That burn injury is like nothing else.
So at what point do you finally just, you probably weren't composed the whole time because it's a crazy, I can only imagine. At what point do you just take a second when you're in the car driving to the hospital and you look down and you go, holy moly, I'm going to die.
That came a little bit earlier when I remember I got sat on a cooler, so I'm totally naked. There's nothing left of my clothes. They're all burnt off, dirty, burnt. And then I just remember, being in shock and like looking at everyone's faces at the party and people were crying. People like had their nose covered because the smell of burnt skin is like nothing you've ever smelled. It's terrible. And so I'm like, okay, this must be bad. And I kind of meet their gaze and look down. And then I realize like, okay, this is serious. And that's when I was like, whoa, and like, how about, you know, I didn't really comprehend the whole thing. I just knew it was serious. Anyways, I run into the emergency room butt naked that night at whatever time. And then everything went black. They knocked me out and then got airlifted to Vancouver.
With medicine. They knocked you with medicine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. With medicine. I'm assuming because that's what.
Just one punched you.
Yeah. And yeah, woke up in Vancouver. And again, that's where the journey really started. But so I won't try and ramble on too much. But so when I, about day three in the burn unit, the first few days were pretty foggy. I don't remember a lot. But there's a procedure called debridement. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's basically torture. They just like, they slice you open and they pressure wash your skin off, and they got to keep those third degree burns clean for future skin grafts. So you had to get that done every third. You're not awake for it.
Because it starts to scab over or try to heal itself.
The scar tissue just gets real thick, real fast. So they have to every third day take all that off.
Aaron. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, man, it's nasty stuff. And so I come out of this first debridement procedure because until then, no one really knew. They knew, I mean, there's only 10 beds in the burn unit in British Columbia at that time. Like, it's the 10 worst burns. So we knew I'm pretty banged up, obviously.
Yeah.
But they don't know kind of to what degree. So I come out of the anesthetic from that first debridement, and then the doctor says, you know, you're obviously very lucky. This could have been a lot worse. You're 40% second, third degree burns. Like, you're going to need a lot of grafting. You're going to be in here for a while.
So how old are you? And
so I'm 19, almost 20.
Okay.
And so to your point, I mean, this is a long-winded answer, but it's an important part of the story.
No, yeah, it's great.
Like, my NHL and my dream was just to go to college. That's what I wanted to do. You know, I didn't want to be naive and think about playing pro hockey because I really didn't have a reason to, you know, I mean, again, you've seen my stats in junior. I didn't even talk to an NCAA scout until this point. So I'm like, but I could always hit. So I'm like, and I slowly added a layer to my game every year. I penalty killed my second year. And then my third year, I was like, maybe I can play on like the third line and just be that guy and get a scholarship. I mean, Vernon was one of the best teams in the country, so that helped too. And so in my head, I'm wrapped like a mummy. I can't move. And this doctor's laying this, you know, this information to me. And I said, well, I have camp in 3.5 months or whatever. So this is in like end of April. Yeah. And we have camp in like start of September, right? Or even before that.
Yeah, August, end of August.
Yeah. And I'll never forget his face. He kind of just froze. And it was like one of this poor kid thinks he's going to be playing hockey in a few months. And he's like, listen, these recoveries take years, not months. Wow. He's like, you're not going to be playing hockey in a few months here. Maybe in a couple years, we'll look to get you in a pair of skates in a non-competitive environment kind of thing. But let's just focus on your recovery. You're going to be in here for a while and it's going to be a long road. And that was the dialogue. And so my career was over at that moment. I'm like, okay. I mean, I was just happy I was going to make a full recovery.
Yeah.
Right. But I was also, on the other hand, you know, that identity gets taken away from you. And it's like, okay, what am I going to do with my life now? I mean, I was young, but hockey was all, you know.
So right? Like you talk about mental strength. Like, you're 19. You're not even fully mentally developed yet. Men don't get there until they're 25, 30. Like,
I got thrust into that because of this, right?
So what do you do? Do you just, you have a good cry, you figure it out, and then you, like, make a decision?
Yeah, I mean, somewhat. So 2 weeks go by, and I was doing just that, you know, having a good, I mean, the pain pretty much just was the main thing you're trying to cope with, because it's like, again, the burn unit is not a good place. And I get a call from my coach 2 weeks in, and he's like, hey, you know, how you doing? And trying to find some sick humor in the whole thing. And I was like, well, you know, not great, been better. And he said, I was just talking to the assistant coach from Brown University, and he's like, we're looking for this type of player. His exact words were, "We want a guy to put the fear of God in the defenseman of the Ivy League." And my coach is like, "I got the perfect guy for you."
That's funny.
There's just one problem, one major problem. He's in the burn unit and the future doesn't look great. So my coach is like, "They want to talk. You just call them." He's like, "I know you got the time." And so I had a little laugh and my parents take down the number. Cause you got to remember, I'm full mummy. I like can't move. My parents hold the phone up to my ear and I talk to this coach from Brown. First time I've heard a Rhode Island accent, which was interesting. And he was, I don't know, you might know Danny Brooks. He scouts in the NHL now, but mm-hmm. just a character. And it was left really open-ended. You know, he said, "We're sorry to hear what happened. We wish you the best in recovery," kind of thing. And that was kind of it. And I remember hanging up the phone. And again, you want to talk about getting emotional. I'm like, I've worked my whole life to talk to one of these guys. And I'm like, look where I am. Look what I've done to myself.
I blew it. Yeah.
I blew it. And then I just remember I started asking questions in my head. I'm like, okay, so why can't I play hockey? And there was a huge list of reasons why.
Yeah.
You know, infection was probably the biggest. With burns, it's a major risk. And then the skin grafts were going to be very limiting, very painful. Just they're going to take years to heal.
Mm-hmm.
I had to wear a full body suit for 2 years. You can't sweat. So at the time, they're like, if you're going to have grafts to 30, 40% of your body, there could be complications there with heart rate and sweating, right? Because you burn through everything. And
why can't you sweat?
Because a third degree burn, you burn through everything. So it's so deep. You can't, so I can't feel my skin grafts because there's no nerves there. So nerve glands, sweat glands, everything. And so when your heart rate gets up, you need to sweat, obviously, right? And that's anytime you're, so I was just, I think, under that cusp maybe, but if you're over 50% grafts, there's major complications there when your heart rate gets going. So anyways, there's this huge list of reasons why they're saying I can't play. And to your point, there's a lot of power in just making a choice and a decision. Yeah. And I said, I'm like, that's not going to be me. I don't accept this diagnosis. And I really made my mentality was I'm willing to die before I give up on that. And I'm going to see it through and make sure this happens. And that's where people ask me, like, how did you discover visualization? And this is how. I didn't have a choice because I was bedridden in a hospital. All I could do was think all day. And prior to that, it was all, I mean, mostly dealing with the pain, but all the negative stuff that came along with that. Like, look, what's my life going to look like now? Poor me. All these negative things, right?
And so do you think that, it's funny, I'm religious. We have this thing and so a small mustard seed and it grows into a massive plant. Mm-hmm. Do you think that one phone call, even though it was just completely innocuous, open-ended, if you didn't have that call, what happens to you?
Yeah, I don't know. And I've thought about that and people have asked me that. And I don't think I would have came back.
Yeah.
I really don't. So I always like to say, I mean, to that kind of related to that is that I think like all of us have a path or a map set out for us mm-hmm. in life.
Oh, definitely.
Right. And some people don't believe that, or they do believe that, but they can't navigate it because it gets hard at times and then they make a different turn. But I think my point with that is that there's signs along the way, you know, in life. And I've had a lot of them. And this is mm-hmm. This was the first major one I had, or like fork in the road, right? Where it's like, hey, they're dangling a carrot over here. Like, you know, maybe you should go down this one. It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, I think I probably, my life looks a lot different if I don't get that call.
Well, you don't got some fancy jerseys hanging behind you.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah, there'll be maybe jerseys of you and some other guys.
I'll send you a jersey. We'll get you some decent players right there. But
let me ask you. I have a quick question. Ahead, okay, this is really fascinating. I want to hear more about the mentality stuff, because I want to remind the listeners that this decision point and you rejecting the doctor's diagnosis and the timeline, you're kind of taking it into your own hands. The NHL is still not even on your radar at this point. This is just to play college hockey, right?
It's not even remotely on my radar. No. And so it's funny. I actually did a podcast yesterday with called Girls with Graphs. So burn survivor community. And I told them, and I always say this, like, I'm not necessarily advocating for people to defy doctors. I think the point is, like, don't let an injury, maybe specifically a burn injury, don't let it define you or define the rest of your life, because I almost did. And like you said, I don't have any of these behind me if I don't do that. So going back to the visualization piece, I just started visualizing, like, again, like, all I could do is think. So all day long, I started creating like a movie in my head, and I just started imagining like a bunch of things. I imagined healing faster, like at a cellular level. Like, I just imagine those graft areas getting smaller and shrinking and healing. Imagine walking out of the hospital and then putting on my gear for that home opener, that game. And then I would just obsess over signing that commitment letter to Brown over and over and over and over again. And I would just start, I started reframing the pain. So I would just be like, this is your body healing. And I almost imagine like my body was like eating the pain, if that makes sense. And the mind's so crazy powerful. Like, the pain started getting more manageable, and I started feeling better. And people think I'm crazy when I say this, but I know I healed faster in the burn unit because of this. Long story short, it worked. And I ended up getting a scholarship to Brown. I mean, it's not technically a scholarship, as you know, with the Ivy
League. Academic assistance or whatever.
Yeah. I just say scholarship, but. Yeah.
Just imagine winning the lottery this Christmas.
Winning it around Christmas, like, you could just do Christmas on a whole different level, couldn't you?
I mean, I'm already buzzing. It's Christmas.
Yeah, I'm already
having the best time ever. And now I've won this as well. Who's the first person you'd tell? You'd have to tell your family straight away, I think.
Yeah, of course. I'd scream so loud that the whole of the street would know.
Everybody would know straight away with me. But you wouldn't believe it. I'd keep checking and checking.
Go on. Just imagine a win this Christmas. The National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Oh, I'm so sorry I'm late, sweetie. I'm sure you were the best pine tree the school's ever seen.
But you missed my deforestation scene. Where were you?
I got held up, I'm afraid. Daddy had to sort out landlord insurance on a comparison site.
Who did you choose?
A Direct Line.
Dad, everyone knows Direct Line on comparison sites. I'm not angry, I'm disappointed.
Search Direct Line, because everyone knows we're not on comparison sites.
But hey, that doesn't mean it was an easy road. Like, my body fought back with everything it had. Because the doctors were right. I had no business. I shouldn't have been playing hockey. Like, if you would have seen, like, what I looked like under my gear that year, like, people were like, what is this guy doing? Like, I had open second-degree burns still under my gear.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I don't know, man. I had kidney stones the day after I got out of the burn unit. I had an appendectomy a week before training camp. They had to cut through my graft on my stomach. So I had every reason to quit, and it was hard. And I had a pelvis issue because the burns to my thighs were so deep that I had major stability issues with my pelvis, and I was on crutches coming to and from the rink. And I had this mentality where I was, and this is when you could also get shot up with any painkiller you wanted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that didn't hurt. The Toradol was flowing for sure. But anyways, Brown comes to watch me. I get a scholarship a few weeks later.
Wow.
And then that's why I only played 20 something games my last year in junior, because I was holding on by a thread. I wouldn't have made it the whole year. So to your point, Tim, so I go to Brown and I just had fun, man. Like, I worked my butt off and I was in shape, but I was like, you know, college fourth line out of the lineup sometimes. They had my 10 points a year in 30 whatever games, nothing crazy. And yeah, my perspective on life had also changed, where I'm just like, I did it. I reached my NHL, and I'm just going to go live it up and have a good time. And that's what I did. And I was 24 years old in my junior year and still had never even thought about pro hockey. I mean, some guys were like, hey, you could go play in the SP or the CHL to say you did it. And I'm like, that didn't appeal to me really, like, to try. I took pre-med, so I was like, going to go that road. And my, again, so I had another like kind of sign on this map. My assistant coach after my junior year was like, pulled me aside after the season and said, hey, you ever thought about playing pro hockey? And I laughed. I was like, dude, I'm 24 years old and I'm on the fourth line in college. Like, no, I've never thought about it.
Yeah.
When he's like, I've never seen anyone hit the way you can hit. I think if you like really worked on your game, I think you could have a solid like 5-10 year career in the American League and, you know, maybe even get a shot in the show one day. And I was like, wow, thank you. And I didn't really know what to say. And I went home that night and I kind of, again, I had this moment where I was like, hey, ding dong, like, what have you been doing these last few years? You know? And I'm like, man, if I can do that and come back from this crazy burn injury to just even come back to play hockey, then why can't I play in the NHL? And that seemed to be an easier task than the burn injury. So I just made a choice. I said, I'm going to play in the NHL.
Well, again, yeah. I think men are wired that way. You need that dangling carrot, something to go for, because while I did the same thing at Tech. Tim always says I make it about myself. I had my same assistant coach. He's like, hey, John, you can't coach 6'8". Like, you got something other people don't have. Like, let's try to figure this out.
Right.
And you need that carrot to kind of go for. So you had it with the phone call with Brown. You had the assistant coach. You had obviously some foresight to give you that. You end up having a fantastic senior season. You light it up. You're putting a point per game, a ton of PIMs for some reason. I don't know if you're just getting 10 minute misconducts or what.
Yeah, maybe the odd one, but mostly just I was killing guys in my last year. Like, I'm 25 playing against 18 year olds.
Yeah.
I was probably 215. My senior year, and I there's more, like, I became obsessed and I had to go back to the visualization piece. So there's a reason that that senior year was so good.
And then you get the call from Vancouver. You're a free agent, which is a benefit to you at this point,
right?
You're not tied to a team. You're coming out. People were probably salivating. Let's get this guy. Why Vancouver? Yeah. Why pick that situation when you knew their depth chart was insane?
I mean, part of it was money at the time, because I had none. I had negative money, you know, like, my family was very working class. And so Vancouver offered me a really good deal, two-way deal, compared to the other ones. The other ones were your typical two-way, 60K in the American League minimum in the NHL.
Yeah.
And Vancouver was paying me a lot of money in the minors. So I'm not going to lie, that was a big factor. I didn't know how long this career was going to last.
Yeah.
So that was a big reason for it. They were the first team to approach me. And I mean, the fact that it was my home province team didn't hurt. So those were the main factors for sure. But yeah, to your point, being a free agent it was the best thing that could have happened, because, you know, I think I had like 6 or 7 or 8 contract offers. And
no kidding.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's the cool part about the story. You know, at 24, I don't think anyone in the NHL even knew who I was. And then within 6, 7 months, 8 months, I was probably, again, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I went from no one knowing to everyone knowing.
Yeah.
And probably a top 5 NCAA free agent. Again, the points weren't out of this world, but it's more when I had that complete package now. Again, I don't want to advocate for hurting people, but, you know, I had this mentality like, get out of my way or get your head up, because I'm going here. And yeah, you're playing against younger kids, and I was just, you know, physically dominating, and then having the points, it just put that whole package together.
So I got to fast forward a little bit. So you're playing in the A, you're getting some pro experience. What are the conversations like with the NHL coaches? Your first call up, your first skate, like what is that? Walk us through that.
Yeah, that's a funny story, because when I first started in the American League, I was slotted like top 6 because I had a good senior year. They signed me for a lot of money. I played a great first couple games. Had two assists my first games. Hit a post on the power play. I fought Wade Brookbank, which, you know, that's more like your weight class.
And he's a tough kid.
Tough dude, man. But so I remember it was like spur of the moment. I never did good with the square offs. I struggled with those. But the spur of the moment, I kind of tagged him with one. We're skating to the bench and he was real mad. He's like yelling at me, "We're going again." And I was like, "Oh man, that was, I didn't know it was him."
No, we're not.
I didn't know it was him. I was like, "I'm taking that win, man. Sorry. I ain't fighting. I'm not squaring off with you." But anyways, I had a good first few games and I was like, wow, like, you know, I could really do this thing maybe in the NHL, be not a top six, but maybe a third liner kind of thing. And then of course things start drying up and I just couldn't. And then I got back to the fourth line. You know how it is in pro, you're not going to produce. Like there's lots of guys that we can bring up that can. And so I just started fighting all the time and I did pretty well. But the reason that it's a little bit funny is because I was like the odd healthy scratch in the minors by game 10, 15, 20 and barely holding a lineup spot. But I had this game in Abbotsford. I called it the double homicide. I had a few of them that year where I'd hit a guy, he'd be out. I'd hit a guy, he'd be out cold. Again, I'm not advocating for hurting anyone, but I got called up a week later. And fought a guy, put him down. So they're both lying on the ice. And this is in Abbotsford. So all the Canucks brass is there. And
you just leave the ice and pack your gear and go to Vancouver after every knockout.
Pretty much in a way. But so I'm back in Manitoba. The coach calls me into his office. It was Claude Noel. And him and I didn't really, we got into it a few times. Just so that the dynamic was the Moose wanted way more from me. Because they're like, we're paying you a pretty good salary here. Like, and they're paying some of it, right? In the minors with the being privately owned.
Yeah. I think. Talk fighting. Like you're talking points, not fighting.
Points. Right. Okay. They want points. They want production. Yeah. They're like, we're paying you a lot of money like to produce. And yeah. Vancouver and my agent are calling me. They're like, we love it. Like, keep doing what you're doing. And so I'm like, who the hell do I listen to?
Vancouver.
Right. Yeah. And that's what my agent said. He's like, where do you want to play?
Yeah.
So anyways, this coach calls me in right before Christmas with the Moose. And I'm thinking he's going to like, we're going to get into it again. And he's going to say, you're not playing tonight. I need more from you. And he kind of just shakes his head. He's like, pack your bag. You're going up to Vancouver. I was like, whoa, I didn't expect that. But that's how it all went down and went up and stayed up for about 2 months, my first year. And that was the year they went to the finals. So we had a stacked team.
Yeah, that's the year they beat. I was with the Hawks game seven in overtime. That was crazy.
Yeah.
But I don't want to skip past fighting because I obviously have been in a few fights myself. You're not a big dude. You're a very efficient puncher. You have a piston for an arm where it just you start and you don't stop. How do you get that mentality? Because the way you fight, you're going to eat punches. Like you're not playing defense, which is I love fighting guys like that. Well, how do you approach a fight?
Well,
like
you
that?
Do. You're 6'9".
Well, because no one reaches me, so I'm like, let's do this. The only guy who could reach me was Fraser McLaren. He had these massive arms.
Yeah.
But when you're going into a game and you're going to fight it, like you fought some heavies. Like, what's your mentality going into that?
Yeah, well, that started to change a little bit. With the bigger dudes, especially.
Yeah.
Like, so I boxed growing up. My dad was a gold gloves boxer.
That helps.
So we boxed. I could throw both hands really well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I didn't have a lot of defense. And part of that was through junior when I was a fighter. Not a lot of guys had maybe the knockout power, maybe like that they would in pro, right? You're not quite a man. It's not to say you couldn't, but I could get away with it. And I won most of my fights because I would just. Yeah, my face would look a little barked up, but people didn't really want to hang in there and go shot for shot. So then in college, you don't fight.
Yeah.
So I translated that into pro and it served me well for the most part. But once I started fighting guys like Revo and like Brad Staubitz and like, I don't know, all those kind of guys, right?
Bigger, like even like a Brad Winchester, bigger. Guys who are bigger than you.
Yeah. And that's when. You know, I could list off a handful of them, but when I'm going shot for shot with Revo and he dings one off my helmet, I'm like, that's probably not the smartest thing, because if he puts one here, I'm going to be sleeping.
Yeah.
So I went for the takedown. But so I had to get a little bit smarter. But when I fought guys, you know, Brownie or Toots, those guys, and I'd go shot for shot with them, I got away with it. I mean, I say that in a not knocked out, got away with it. But man, those guys were bulldogs. And I don't, you know, I almost found the smaller guys in a way harder to fight. Because
I say that always. I couldn't.
Yeah,
they're Cam Jansen.
They're like this and they're punching up.
Yeah.
Where you as a big guy, unless you sneak in an uppercut. I mean, some of my best fights were with bigger guys, because I would kind of like, I'd hold them, but I'd protect myself and I'd let them ding a few off my helmet. And as long as I don't get hit with an uppercut, I could even like kind of like go down on a knee and then come up real quick and they don't expect it. You know, I remember I fought Andy Sutton and I tagged him with one of those. And yeah, I don't know. It was just, I guess my point is I definitely had to get a little smarter.
Yeah.
As time went on, because the first couple of years pro, I was like, I didn't mind the role. I liked it. And I'm like, bring it on. I like black eyes and live that fighter stereotype. But, you know, after that summer we had with those guys that lost their lives. And then I started thinking more about my health. And I'm like, I've had a lot of concussions and I'd rather not get punched in the head by, you know, someone that's 6'5", 240. Like, what's that going to do for me later? So I started thinking about that more and tried to get a little smarter. But that's when it started getting tough, you know, with the anxiety stuff, as a lot of guys will, you know, I don't know how you felt, but.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
I can't remember which podcast I was listening to. It could have even been yours. It was someone's, but they said it perfectly. It was like, imagine the bully in your school comes to you early in the morning and he's the biggest, toughest kid in school and says, hey, I'm taking you out back and the whole school is going to be watching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you feel all day? You're thinking about that. And, you know, it's, you get anxious about it. And that's kind of it's similar in the NHL, you know, okay, I get in a fight with whoever. And then right away in my head, I can usually make it through that next game. But right after that game, I'm like, oh, I got Revo in 2 days. Guess what? I'm thinking about that for 2 days.
Well, that's right? The maddening part about the NHL or pro hockey. It's like you can go to the calendar and be like, all right. For me, it was like, I got McIntyre, McGrattan, or McLaren. Like, Murderer's Row. And was like, oh, geez.
I'd rather not do that, right?
Yeah, I'm going to say no to that guy. Yeah. And I'm going to lose my job, so I have to say yes. So I got one more fight.
That was it.
Which one? Pick one fight for the listeners to go and watch. Which one are you most proud of?
Oh, that's a good question. It'd probably have to be the Winchester fight, because that was my welcome to the NHL full-time moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was another double homicide that game. I knocked out Demers from a hit earlier.
Jason Demers, friend of the show.
Oh, no. Yeah, sorry, Demers. Not like, he was hurt. He didn't come back. But, and then Winchester, you know, this was exhibition. And so I don't know why he did it, but he kind of sprinted at me. And went to grab me, and I was kind of put off guard, and I just took a step back, and he kind of missed his grab and left himself open. And
bonk.
After that game, Stan Smeal, I remember, gave me like a wink, like, and I was like, I knew I made it, you know, for real, because that was my second year, and we had just lost to the Bruins, and we needed to get tougher. And they brought in like Owen Knoll and Todd Fedoric, all these guys into camp, and I had that game, and I knew that was it. So. There's a bunch of other good ones, but that's probably the most impactful.
It's funny, Mon, one of my favorite ones that I watch daily is versus the Canucks, where I fought Alexander Bolduc.
I remember.
I separated both his shoulders, I think, and he had a concussion. He was out for the year, I think.
But I remember. I don't know if I was up. I remember the story for sure, and everyone was just yelling at him like, no.
Rippon was screaming
from
the bench.
Don't do it, Duker.
Well, the scary thing was, I was with the Wild at that point, And we were up by 5-2, and we had Derek Boogaard.
Right.
And so Hordachuk jumps on the ice, and he's trying to, you know, fight me.
Yeah.
And Boogie's like, nah, you're going to fight me. And Boogaard was, like, talk about toughest guy ever. So he grabs Hordachuk and beats him up, and Bolduc jumps over the boards, and he's like, I have to fight you. Like, no, you don't. Like, you don't have to. And I'm like, all right, man. I had never heard of him before. I didn't know he was tough. And I just, like, it was not good. And beat him up. And that was my first, like, kind of foray into the Vancouver. Because you guys were tough. You had a tough team. You had Rippon, yourself at a time. You had Hordachuk. You had, Bolduc.
Glasser.
You know, Tanner Glass. Tanner Glass. But all gamers. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, we had a, that was a, I mean, people say that first, that 2010 to 12, like, that was maybe some of the best teams they ever had. And it wasn't, that was when I mean, aside from Hordy, we didn't really have, like, true heavyweights. You know, we could play. I mean, my stats don't really show that, but, you know, we could skate and make plays. But yeah, that was when, you know, the fourth line wasn't necessarily expected to contribute. It was kind of a bonus.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're providing energy and that sandpaper, you'll play.
Our fourth line was up. We had Voros, we had Boogaard, and we had Clutterbuck. And I would jump on defense. And if we got up by 3 goals, the other team's tough guys were just like, gosh, what are we going to do? Like, who are we going to fight? It was bad.
That was the worst, man. Like, if your team was down by a few goals with 10 minutes left, it's like, ugh. You're like, I kind of have a headache from the last fight and my hands are messed. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, you know, I'd rather not. But if I don't, am I going to be here tomorrow? Like, that's the tough part, right?
I always hated in the first period if they scored on the first, because I would get the fourth shift unless there was a penalty. Then I'd get the sixth shift, seventh shift.
Yeah.
If they scored early, I'm like, damn it.
Oh, no.
Now I got to go fight first shift. Like, I'm not even into the game. I don't want to do this. But before, you could be like, sorry, man, tie game. Like, let's just get into the game. Like, let's go play a little bit. I would never ask. Because I wanted to play, but if I was down a goal, son of a gun, like, now we got to go fight in your cult. And I hated doing that. I didn't like the stage fights. I despise it. Tim used to fight all the time. He loved just squaring up with guys. Tim's never thrown a totally punch at anybody.
I do want to ask about this Canucks team, because I think you're the first guy we've interviewed who's part of that core, and it's probably one of the best cores the last 20 years with Luongo, Sedins, and Burrows, and Bieksa, and all those guys. But they never won a cup.
Volpatti.
I know it's hard, obviously, and not every team's gonna get that cup. But do you have any ideas or insights into why that group was never able to kind of get over that hump and get it done?
That's a good question. I mean, it was so close, right?
Yeah.
So I was a black ace on that run. So we kind of had, like, our own, you know, how it works.
You're kind of
in your own world. You're not really part of the team. But I don't know. Like, I know guys said that there was a lot of nerves before the game, and that might have had something to do with it, versus the Bruins apparently were just, you know, really kept it light and treated it like any other game. So I think that could have been part of it. As a whole, I don't think there's a specific reason, really. I mean, that was a deep, deep team. It's a good league, and, you know, it's tough to win, and it's, you know, little things can just make a difference, like maybe being too nervous, and that was the final straw, maybe, right? But I don't know. It could have. I think a lot of guys said that Aaron Rome hit changed the whole series.
Oh,
right, and it did. That it changed everything, because we were up, I think, 3-1 or 2-1 at the time. So I don't know. Like, you're so close. I mean, we could have won in 5 or 6 games, and then it's a whole different, you know, conversation. So I don't think there's any reason or anything specific as to why, but I think once Game 7 hit, there was a lot of, you could feel the tension in the whole city. And I think it was maybe just too much.
So I don't know how much you keep up with, like, the headlines, but yesterday Chara shared this story, and you know what I'm going to say? He said, they didn't personally see it, but on Game 6 in Boston, the Canucks players were reportedly practicing and talking about how they were going to hand off the cup. And like in Boston, really? They were planning on winning that night.
No
and
they said, way. Like, I don't believe it.
So
I don't know that. I can't say. I lived in the Black East.
Go ahead. Right. Sorry.
And so I guess the trainers or the arena staff like told them because they were watching the Canucks practice or something. And that was yesterday. He was on some show talking about it. And Bieksa like last night or early this morning commented like that absolutely did not happen. There's no chance.
0%. I find that hard to believe. Yeah.
And I think Chara believes it. I don't think
he'd be one to just throw things out like that. No.
Right. But I was going to ask. I don't. That doesn't sound
familiar. Big Z's the biggest dirtbag that's ever put skates on.
Just a bad human.
Talk about a guy who would dunk a fight. I would ask him relentlessly. He picks his point. You only play 7 minutes. I'm like, I don't care. Still beat the doors off, Big Z.
I find that hard to believe. But again, I didn't. Yeah. We kind of lived on the sidelines a little bit. One quick funny story with that series. So they put us Black Aces in Boston in the stands with the wives. Like, who drew that one up?
The Bruins wives too, which was strange.
Oh my God. And man, like I legit thought I was gonna get in a fight with these nut jobs in Boston. Like they were calling us and the wives every name you could imagine. And I'm like, I obviously can't get in a fight with a fan, but I feel like this guy's gonna come at me and then I'm going to have no choice. It was bananas.
People from Boston.
They're crazy, but in a good way, like they're the worst, but I mean, they're passionate.
Passionate.
Let's say that.
Fault. Yeah.
To a fault. Maybe.
Tim, but, where are you from?
I'm from Boston.
Oh no.
Love it.
So it was a crazy ride, man.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It was fun to watch your career. I don't want to keep you too much, but the real reason you're here is you're promoting your book. You're on the end of this, getting close to the end of this 54-day book tour, which was your number. Why don't you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, that was a big part of why I wrote the book. I mean, we touched on it a little bit, but at the end of the day, I was like, I can help people with this and help them, you know, tap into the power of the mind and visualization and what we're truly capable of. And the other part was to give back to the burn fund. Because again, like I said, you know, that burn unit is the people that work there are special people because it is not a fun place to recover with those types of injuries. So yeah, at the end of the day, I'm like, I can give back. And so that was a big part of this fundraiser. So for the first 54 days as of October 25th, which is, so we have 9 days left and 54 was my number in Vancouver. 40% of the profits from the book, it's called Fighter, are going back to the burn fund. So, and that was from 40% second, third degree burns. So
get out, listeners. The book is called Fighter, Defying the NHL Odds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If anything, I promise you'll be entertained. Let's say that.
Well, visualize all these people buying these books, Aaron, and maybe we'll do some good.
Yeah, that's what my practice looks like now. It looks a little bit different than playing hockey, right? But it's not just for athletes. It can translate into anything, right?
I agree.
So
believe it, achieve it. Is that the saying, how it goes? I don't know. I'm not good with that kind of stuff. But anyways, is there anything else you want to touch on, Aaron or Tim, before we get out of here?
I'm good.
No, I think that was great.
That was great, Aaron. You never know what to expect when these interviews. I always come in with this, like, it's going to suck. I'm going to be bored. Because it happens where you get these players on. It's just like, gosh, he's just like dry, watching paint dry. But this was fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on.
I think everyone's got a story, right?
Yeah. Some are bad. Some are so boring.
That's fair.
No, you're very, very well spoken. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And hey, all the best, man, going forward.
Thank you.
Everybody go out, get his book. What is it? Fighter, Defying the Odds, Road to the NHL. I butchered the title.
Defying the NHL Odds. Yeah.
Yeah. So go out, can they pick it up anywhere? Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazon on my website, AaronValpatti.com. Amazon's probably the easiest. So
get it within the next 9 days. So you make some money. Yeah. Get some money to that burn unit. It's a good stuff. Aaron, thank you for coming on the show. We appreciate it. Good luck with everything. Cheers.
Thanks, everybody. Guys. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dropping the Gloves with John Scott, a member of the Nation Network of Podcasts. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from to never miss an episode.
Delivered by DoorDash.
At Asda, we believe every pig deserves a maple blanket. That's why we've been as busy as elves in the North Pole to bring you our amazing maple pigs in blankets. Enjoy succulent sausage wrapped in bacon with a sweet sugary sprinkle. Deliciousness all wrapped up.
Great job, everybody!
And the best thing, they're only £2.50. Have your elf a Merry Christmas at Asda. Tested and approved by the Good Housekeeping Institute 2022. 232 grams. Selected Asda store subject to availability.
I'm terribly sorry. Simon will be joining the meeting soon. He knows it's very important.
Sorry. Hi. So sorry I'm late.
No problem. I'm sure you've got a very good reason, Simon.
Yes, I was sorting out our business insurance on a comparison site.
Oh, yeah? Who'd you go for?
Direct Line.
Everyone knows Direct Line aren't on comparison sites.
You can drop off now, Simon.
Search Direct Line, because everyone knows we're not on comparison sites.